Chapter 86. The Fire Itself. 6 lashes and expulsion, the Chancellor said heavily. Expulsion, I thought numbly, as if I had never heard the word before. To expel, to cast violently away. I could feel Ambrose's satisfaction radiating outward. For a second, I was afraid that I was going to be violently ill right there in front of everyone. "Does any master oppose this action?" the Chancellor asked ritualistically as I looked down at my feet. "I do." The stirring voice could only be Elodin's. "All in favor of suspending expulsion?" I looked up again in time to see Elodin's hand, Elxadal's, Kilvin, Lauren, the Chancellor. All hands save Hems. I almost laughed out of shock and sheer disbelief. Elodin gave me his boyish smile again. "Expulsion repealed," the Chancellor said firmly, and I felt Ambrose's satisfaction flicker and wane beside me. "Are there any further issues?" I caught an odd note in the Chancellor's voice. He was expecting something. It was Elodin who spoke. "I move that Quoth be raised to the rank of Relar." "All in favor?" All hands save Hems were raised in a single motion. "Quoth is raised to Relar with Elodin as sponsor on the 5th of Fallow. Meeting adjourned." He pushed himself up from the table and made his way to the door. "What?" Ambrose yelled, looking around as if he couldn't decide who he was asking. Finally, he scampered off after Hem, who was making a quick exit behind the Chancellor and the majority of the other masters. I noticed he wasn't limping nearly as much as he had before the trial began. Bewildered, I stood stupidly until Elodin came over and shook my unresponsive hand. "Confused?" he asked. "Come walk with me. I'll explain." The bright afternoon sunlight was a shock after the shadowy cool of Hollows. Elodin awkwardly pulled his master's robes up over his head. Underneath, he was wearing a simple white shirt and a pair of rather disreputable-looking pants held up by a piece of frayed rope. I saw for the first time that he was barefoot. The tops of his feet showed the same healthy tan as his arms and face. "Do you know what Relar means?" he asked me conversationally. "It translates as speaker," I said. "Do you know what it means?" he stressed the word. "Not really," I admitted. Elodin drew a deep breath. "Once upon a time, there was a university. It was built in the dead ruins of an older university. It wasn't very big, perhaps 50 people in all, but it was the best university for miles and miles, so people came and learned and left. There was a small group of people who gathered there, people whose knowledge went beyond mathematics and grammar and rhetoric. They started a smaller group inside the university. They called it the Arcanum, and it was a very small, very secret thing. They had a ranking system among themselves, and your rise through those ranks was due to prowess and nothing else. One entered this group by proving they could see things for what they really were. They became Elir, which means seer. How do you think they became Relar?" He looked at me expectantly. "By speaking?" He laughed. "Right!" He stopped and turned to face me. "But speaking what?" His eyes were bright and sharp. "Words?" "Names," he said excitedly. "Names are the shape of the world, and a man who can speak them is on the road to power. Back in the beginning, the Arcanum was a small collection of men who understood things. Men who knew powerful names. They taught a few students, slowly, carefully encouraging them toward power and wisdom. And magic. Real magic." He looked around at the buildings and milling students. "In those days, the Arcanum was a strong brandy. Now, it is well-watered wine." I waited until I was sure he was finished. "Master Elodin, what happened yesterday?" I held my breath and hoped beyond hope for an intelligible answer. He gave me a quizzical look. "You called the name of the wind," he said, as if the answer were obvious. "But what does that mean? And what do you mean by name? Is it just a name like Quoth or Elodin? Or is it more like Taberlin knew the names of many things? Like both, he said, waving to a pretty girl leaning out a second-story window. But how can a name do something like that? Quoth and Elodin are just sounds we make. They don't have any power by themselves. Elodin raised his eyebrows at this. Really? Watch. He looked down the street. Nathan! He shouted. A boy turned to look in our direction. I recognized him as one of Jameson's errand boys. Nathan, come here! The boy trotted over and looked up at Elodin.
Yes, sir.
Elodin handed the boy his master's robe. Nathan, would you take this to my rooms for me?
Certainly, sir.
The boy took the robe and hurried away. Elodin looked at me. Do you see? The names we call each other are not names, but they have some power nonetheless. That's not magic, I protested. He had to listen to you. You're a master. And you're a Raylar, he said implacably. You called the wind, and the wind listened. I struggled with the concept. You're saying the wind is alive? He made a vague gesture. In a way. Most things are alive in one way or another. I decided to take a different tack. How did I call the wind if I didn't know how? Elodin clapped his hands together sharply. That is an excellent question. The answer is that each of us has two minds, a waking mind and a sleeping mind. Our waking mind is what thinks and talks and reasons, but the sleeping mind is more powerful. It sees deeply to the heart of things. It is the part of us that dreams. It remembers everything. It gives us intuition. Your waking mind does not understand the nature of names. Your sleeping mind does. It already knows many things that your waking mind does not. Elodin looked at me. Remember how you felt after you called the name of the wind? I nodded, not enjoying the memory. When Ambrose broke your lute, it roused your sleeping mind. Like a great hibernating bear jabbed with a burning stick, it reared up and roared the name of the wind. He swung his arms around wildly, attracting odd looks from passing students. Afterward, your waking mind did not know what to do. It was left with an angry bear. What did you do? I can't remember what you whispered to me. It was a name. It was a name that settled the angry bear, eased it back to sleep. But it is not sleeping so soundly now. We need to rouse it slowly and bring it under your control. Is that why you moved to suspend my expulsion? He made a dismissive gesture. You were in no real danger of being expelled. You were not the first student to call the name of the wind in anger, though you are the first in several years. Some strong emotion usually wakes the sleeping mind for the first time. He smiled. The name of the wind came to me when I was arguing with Elxadal. When I shouted it, his braziers exploded in a cloud of burning ash and cinder. He chuckled. What did he do to make you so angry? He refused to teach me the advanced bindings. I was only 14 and an Ilir. He told me I would have to wait until I was a Raylar. There are advanced bindings? He grinned at me. Secrets, Raylar quoth. That is what being an Arcanist is all about. Now that you are a Raylar, you are entitled to certain things that were withheld before. The advanced sympathetic bindings, the nature of names, some smattering of dubious runes if Kilvin thinks you are ready. Hope rose in my chest. Does this mean I'm allowed access to the archives now? Ah, Elodin said. No, not in the least. You see, the archives are Lauren's domain, his kingdom. Those secrets are not mine to give away. At his mention of secrets, my mind settled on one that had been bothering me for months. The secret at the heart of the archives. What about the stone door in the archives? I asked. The four-plate door. Now that I'm a Raylar, can you tell me what's behind it? Elodin laughed. Oh, no! No, no! You don't aim for small secrets, do you? He clapped me on the back as if I'd just made an especially good joke. Velaritas! God! I can still remember what it was like standing down there looking at the door, wondering. He laughed again. Merciful Taylor, it almost killed me. He shook his head. No, you don't get to go behind the four-plate door. But, he gave me a conspiratorial look, since you are a Raylar. He looked from side to side, as if afraid that someone might overhear us. I leaned closer. Since you are a Raylar, I will admit that it exists. He gave me a solemn wink. Disappointed as I was, I couldn't help but smile. We walked for a while in silence, past mains, past anchors. Master Elodin? Yes? His eyes followed a squirrel across the road and up a tree. I still don't understand about names. I will teach you to understand, he said easily. The nature of names cannot be described, only experienced and understood. Why can't it be described? I asked. If you understand a thing, you can describe it. Can you describe all the things you understand? He looked sideways at me. Of course. Elodin pointed down the street. What color is that boy's shirt? Blue. What do you mean by blue? Describe it. I struggled for a moment. Failed. So blue is a name? It is a word. Words are pale shadows of forgotten names. As names have power, words have power. Words can light fires in the mind of men. Words can wring tears from the hardest hearts. There are 7 words that will make a person love you. There are 10 words that will break a strong man's will. But a word is nothing but a painting of a fire. A name is the fire itself. My head was swimming by this point. I still don't understand. He laid a hand on my shoulder. Using words to talk of words is like using a pencil to draw a picture of itself, on itself. Impossible. Confusing. Frustrating. He lifted his hands high above his head as if stretching for the sky. But there are other ways to understanding! He shouted, laughing like a child. He threw both arms to the cloudless arch of sky above us, still laughing. Look! He shouted, tilting his head back. Blue! 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 Chapter 87 Winter. He's quite mad, I said to Simon and Willem later that afternoon at Anchor's. He's a master, Sim responded tactfully. And your sponsor. And from what you've told us, he's the reason you weren't expelled. I'm not saying that he isn't intelligent. And I've seen him do things that I can't begin to explain. But the fact remains that he is completely off his nut. He talks in circles about names and words and power. It sounds good while he's saying it, but it doesn't really mean anything. Quit complaining, Simmons said. You beat both of us to Raylar. Even if your sponsor is cracked. And you got paid 2 span of silver for breaking Ambrose's arm. You got away free as a bird. I wish I had half your luck. Not quite free as a bird, I said. I'm still going to be whipped. What? Sim said. I thought you said that they suspended it. They suspended my expulsion, I said. Not the whipping. Simon gaped. My God, why not?
Malfeasance, Willem said in a low voice. They can't let a student get off bird free after they voted him guilty of malfeasance.
That's what Elodin said. I took a drink. Took another. I don't care, Simon said hotly. It's barbaric. He hammered out his last word on the table with his fist, upsetting his glass and spilling a dark pool of scutton across the table. Shit! He scrambled to his feet and tried to keep it from spilling on the floor with his hands. I laughed helplessly until there was water in my eyes and my stomach ached. I felt a weight lift off my chest as I finally regained my breath. I love you, Sim, I said earnestly. Sometimes I think you're the only honest person I know. He looked me over.
You're drunk.
No, it's the truth. You're a good person. Better than I'll ever be. He gave me a look that said he couldn't tell if he was being made fun of or not. A serving girl came over with wet rags, wiped the table clean, and made a few barbed comments. Sim had the decency to look embarrassed enough for all of us. By the time I made it back to the university, it was fully dark. I stopped briefly at Anchor's to pick up a few things, then made my way onto the roof of Maine's. I was surprised to find Ari waiting for me on the roof despite the clear sky. She sat on a short brick chimney, swinging her bare feet idly. Her hair made a gauzy cloud around her tiny form. She hopped down when I came closer and gave a little half-step sideways that was almost like a curtsy.
"Good evening, both."
"Good evening, Ari," I said. "How are you?"
"I am lovely," she said firmly, "and it is a lovely night."
She held both her hands behind her back and shifted from foot to foot. "What have you brought me tonight?" I asked. She gave her sunny smile.
"What have you brought me?"
I pulled a narrow bottle from underneath my cloak.
"I brought you some honey wine."
She took hold of it with both hands.
"Why, this is a princely gift."
She peered down at it wonderingly.
"Think of all the tipsy bees."
She pulled the cork and sniffed it.
"What's in it?"
"Sunlight," I said, "and a smile, and a question." She held the mouth of the bottle up to her ear and grinned at me.
"The question's at the bottom," I said.
"A heavy question," she said, then held her hand out to me.
"I brought you a ring."
It was made of warm, smooth wood.
"What does it do?"
I asked.
"It keeps secrets," she said.
I held it to my ear. Ari shook her head seriously, her hair swirling around her.
"It doesn't tell them, it keeps them."
She stepped close to me and took the ring, sliding it onto my finger. "It's quite enough to have a secret," she chided me gently. "Anything more would be greedy."
"It fits," I said, somewhat surprised.
"They're your secrets," she said, as if explaining something to a child. "Who else would it fit?" Ari brushed her hair away behind her and made her curious half-step to the side again, almost like a curtsy, almost like a tiny dance.
"I was wondering if you would join me for dinner tonight, Quoth," she said, her face serious.
"I have brought apples and eggs. I can also offer a lovely honey wine."
"I'd love to share dinner with you, Ari," I said formally. "I have brought bread and cheese."
Ari scampered down into the courtyard and in a few minutes returned with a delicate porcelain teacup for me. She poured the honey wine for both of us, drinking hers in a series of dainty sips from a silver beggar's cup hardly bigger than a thimble. I sat down on the roof and we shared our meal. I had a large loaf of brown barley bread and a wedge of hard white Dalinar cheese. Ari had ripe apples and a half dozen brown spotted eggs that she had somehow managed to hard boil. We ate them with salt I brought out from a pocket in my cloak. We shared most of the meal in silence, simply enjoying each other's company. Ari sat cross-legged with her back straight and her hair fanning out to all sides. As always, her careful delicacy somehow made this makeshift meal on a rooftop seem like a formal dinner in some nobleman's hall.
"The wind has been bringing leaves into the underthing lately," Ari said conversationally toward the end of the meal.
"Through the grates and tunnels. They settle in the downings, so things are all a rustle there."
"Is that so?"
She nodded. "And a mother owl has moved in, made her nest right in the middle of the Grey 12. Bold as brass."
"She's something of a rarity, then?"
She nodded.
"Absolutely. Owls are wise. They are careful and patient. Wisdom precludes boldness."
She sipped from her cup, holding the handle daintily between her thumb and forefinger.
"That is why owls make poor heroes."
Wisdom precludes boldness. After my recent adventures in Traven, I couldn't help but agree.
"But this one is adventurous? An explorer?"
"Oh, yes," Ari said, her eyes wide. "She is fearless. She has a face like a wicked moon.
she refilled her tiny silver cup with honey wine and emptied the last of it into my teacup. After tipping the bottle all the way upside down, she pursed her lips and blew across the top of it in two sharp bursts so that it made a hooting noise.
"Where's my question?" she demanded.
I hesitated, unsure as to how she would respond to my request. "I was wondering, Ari, would you mind showing me the underthing?" Ari looked away, suddenly shy. "Quoth, I thought you were a gentleman," she said, tugging self-consciously at her ragged shirt. "Imagine asking to see a girl's underthing." She looked down, her hair hiding her face. I held my breath for a moment, choosing my next words carefully, lest I startle her back underground. While I was thinking, Ari peeked at me through the curtain of her hair.
"Ari," I asked slowly, "are you joking with me?"
She looked up and grinned. "Yes, I am," she said proudly. "Isn't it wonderful?" Ari took me through the heavy metal grate in the abandoned courtyard down into the underthing. I brought out my hand lamp to light the way. Ari had a light of her own, something she held in her cupped hands that gave off a soft, blue-green glow. I was curious about what she held, but didn't want to press her for too many secrets at once. At first, the underthing was exactly what I had expected. Tunnels and pipes. Pipes for sewage, water, steam, and coal gas. Great black pig-iron pipes a man could crawl through. Small, bright brass pipes no bigger around than your thumb. There was a vast network of stone tunnels, branching and connecting at odd angles. If there were any rhyme or reason to the place, it was lost on me. Ari gave me a whirlwind tour, proud as a new mother, excited as a little girl. Her enthusiasm was infectious, and I soon lost myself in the excitement of the moment, ignoring my original reasons for wanting to explore the tunnels. There is nothing quite so delightfully mysterious as a secret in your own backyard. We made our way down three spiral staircases made of black wrought iron to reach the Grey 12. It was like standing in the bottom of a canyon. Looking up, I could see faint moonlight filtering in through drain grates far overhead. The mother owl was gone, but Ari showed me the nest. The deeper we went, the stranger things became. The round tunnels for drainage and pipes disappeared and were replaced with squared-off hallways and stairways strewn with rubble. Rotting wooden doors hung off rusted hinges, and there were half-collapsed rooms filled with moldering tables and chairs. One room had a pair of bricked-up windows, despite the fact that we were, at my best guess, at least 50 feet below ground. Deeper still, we came to Through Bottom, a room like a cathedral, so big that neither Ari's blue light nor my red one reached the highest peaks of the ceiling. All around us were huge ancient machines. Some lay in pieces, broken gears taller than a man, leather straps gone brittle with age, great wooden beams that were now explosions of white fungus, huge as hedgerows. Other machines were intact, but worn by centuries of neglect. I approached an iron block as big as a farmer's cottage, and broke off a single flake of rust large as a dinner plate. Underneath was nothing but more rust. Nearby there were three great pillars covered in green verdigris so thick it looked like moss. Many of the huge machines were beyond identifying, looking more melted than rusted. But I saw something that might have been a water wheel, 3 stories tall, lying in a dry canal that ran like a chasm through the middle of the room. I had only the vaguest of ideas as to what any of the machines might have done. I had no guess at all as to why they had lain here for uncounted centuries, deep underground. There didn't seem... Chapter 88. Interlude. Looking. The sound of heavy boots on the wooden landing startled the men sitting in the Waystone Inn. Quoth bolted to his feet, mid-sentence, and was halfway to the bar before the front door opened and the first of the felling night crowd made their way inside.
"You've got hungry men here, Coat!"
Cobb called out as he opened the door. Shep, Jake, and Graham followed him inside. "We might have a little something in the back," Coat said.
I could run and fetch it straight away, unless you'd like drinks first. There was a chorus of friendly assent as the men settled onto their stools at the bar. The exchange had a well-worn feel, comfortable as old shoes. Chronicler stared at the red-haired man behind the bar. There was nothing left of Kvothe in him. It was just an innkeeper, friendly, servile, and so unassuming as to almost be invisible. Jake took a long drink before noticing Chronicler sitting at the far end of the room.
"Well, look at you, Coat! A new customer! Hell, we're lucky to have gotten any seats at all!"
Shep chuckled. Cobb swiveled his stool around and peered at where Chronicler sat next to Bast, pen still poised over his paper.
"Is he a scribe or summit?"
"He is," Coat said quickly. "Came into town late last night." Cobb squinted toward them.
"What's he writing?"
Coat lowered his voice a bit, drawing the attention of the customers away from the guest and back to his side of the bar. "Remember that trip Bast made to Baden?" They nodded attentively. "Well, turns out he had a scare with the pox, and he's been feeling his years a bit since then. He thought he'd best get his will writ down while he had the chance."
"Sense enough in that these days," Shep said darkly.
He drank off the last of his beer and knocked the empty mug down.
"I'll do another of those."
"Whatsoever monies I have saved at the time of my death shall go to the Widow Sage," Bast said loudly across the room, "to help in raising and dowering her three daughters, as they are soon to be of marrying age." He gave Chronicler a troubled look. "Is marrying a word?"
"Little Katie certainly has grown up a bit this last year, hasn't she?"
Graham mused. The others nodded in agreement. "To my employer I leave my best pair of boots," Bast continued magnanimously, "and whatsoever of my pants he finds fit him."
"Boy does have a fine pair of boots," Cobb said to Coat. "Always thought so."
"I leave to Pater Leoden to distribute the remainder of my worldly goods among the parish, as, being an immortal soul, I will have no further need of them." "You mean immortal, don't you?" Chronicler asked uncertainly. Bast shrugged. "That's all I can think of for now." Chronicler nodded and quickly shuffled the paper, pens, and ink into his flat leather satchel.
"Come on over, then," Cobb called to him. "Don't be a stranger."
Chronicler froze, then made his way slowly toward the bar.
"What's your name, boy?"
"Devon," he said, then looked stricken and cleared his throat. "Excuse me. Carverson. Devon Carverson." Cobb made introductions all around, then turned back to the newcomer.
"Which way are you from, Devon?"
Cobb asked. "Off past Abbotsford."
"Any news from that way?"
Chronicler shifted uncomfortably in his seat while Coat eyed him darkly from the other side of the bar.
"Well, the roads are rather bad."
This sparked a chorus of familiar complaints, and Chronicler relaxed. While they were still grousing, the door opened and the smith's prentice came in, boyish and broad-shouldered, with the smell of coal smoke in his hair. A long rod of iron rested on his shoulder as he held the door open for Carter.
"You look a fool, boy,"
Carter groused as he made his way slowly through the door, walking with the stiff care of the recently injured.
"You keep hauling that around and folk'll start talking about you like they do Crazy Martin. You'll be that crazy boy from Rhenish. You want to listen to that for the next 50 years?
The smith's prentice shifted his grip on the iron bar self-consciously. "Let him talk," he mumbled with a hint of defiance. "Since I went out and took care of Nellie, I've been having dreams about that spider thing." He shook his head.
"Hell, I'd think you'd be carrying one in each hand. That thing could have killed you."
Carter ignored him, his expression stiff as he walked gingerly toward the bar.
"Good to see you up and about, Carter," Shep called out, raising his mug. "I thought we might not see you out of bed for another day or two."
"Take more than a few stitches to keep me down," Carter said.
Bast made a show of offering up his stool to the injured man. then quietly took a seat as far from the smith's prentice as possible. There was a warm murmur of welcome from everyone. The innkeeper ducked into the back room and emerged a few minutes later, carrying a tray loaded with hot bread and steaming bowls of stew. Everyone was listening to Chronicler. If I remember right, Quoth was off in Severin when it happened. He was walking home.
It weren't Severin, old Cobb said. It was off by the university.
Could have been, Chronicler conceded. Anyway, he was walking home late at night, and some bandits jumped him in an alleyway.
It was broad daylight, Cobb said testily. In the middle of town. All manner of folk were around to see it.
Chronicler shook his head stubbornly. I remember an alley. Anyway, the bandits surprised Quoth. They wanted his horse. He paused and rubbed his forehead with the tips of his fingers. Wait, that's not right. He wouldn't have his horse in an alley. Maybe he was on the road to Severin.
I told you it weren't Severin!
Cobb demanded, slapping his hand down on the bar, plainly irritated.
Taylor, anyway, just stop! You've got it all mixed up!
Chronicler flushed in embarrassment. I only heard it once, years ago. Shooting Chronicler a dark look, Coat clattered the tray down loudly onto the bar, and the story was momentarily forgotten. Old Cobb ate so quickly he almost choked himself, and washed it down with a long swallow of beer.
"Seeing as how you're still working on your dinner there," he said none too casually to Chronicler as he wiped his mouth on his sleeve, "would you mind terrible if I picked up the story, just so's the boy can hear it?"
"If you're sure you know it," Chronicler said hesitantly.
"Of course I know it,"
Cobb said as he spun his stool around to face more of his audience.
"All right. Way back when Quoth was just a pup, he went to the university. But he didn't live in the university proper, you see, on account of the fact that he was just ordinary folk. He couldn't afford all the fancy living that went on there."
"How come?" the smith's prentice asked. "You said before that Quoth was so smart, they paid him to stay even though he was just 10 years old. They gave him a purse full of gold, and a diamond big as his thumb knuckle, and a brand new horse with a new saddle and tack and new shoes and a full bag of oats and everything." Cobb gave a conciliatory nod.
"True, that's true. But this was a year or two after Quoth had gotten all that. And you see, he'd gave a lot of that gold to some poor folk whose houses had all burned down."
"Burned down during their wedding," Graham interjected. Cobb nodded.
"And Quoth had to eat and rent a room and buy more oats for his horse. So his gold was all used up by then. So he..."
"What about the diamond?" the boy insisted. Old Cobb gave the barest of frowns.
"If you've got to know, he gave that diamond to a special friend of his. A special lady friend. But that's a whole different story than the one I'm telling now."
He glared at the boy, who dropped his eyes contritely and spooned up a mouthful of stew. Cobb continued.
"Since Quoth couldn't afford all that rich living in the university, he stayed in the town next by instead. Place called Amaray." He shot Chronicler a pointed look. "Quoth had a room in an inn where he got to stay for free because the widow who owned the place took a shine to him, and he did chores to help earn his keep."
"He played music there, too," Jake added. "He was all sorts of clever with his lute."
"Get your dinner into your gob and let me finish my say, Jacob," old Cobb snapped. "Everyone knows Quoth was clever with a lute. That's why the widow had taken such a shine to him in the first place, and playing music every night was part of his chores."
Cobb took a quick drink and continued.
"So one day, Quoth was out running errands for the widow, when a fellow pulls out a knife and tells Quoth if he doesn't hand over the widow's money, he'll spill Quoth's guts all over the street."
Cobb pointed an imaginary knife at the boy and gave him a menacing look.
"Now you've got to remember, this is back when Quoth was just a pup. He ain't got no sword, and even if he did, he ain't learned to fight proper from the Adem yet."
"So what did Quoth do?" the smith's prentice asked.
"Well," Cobb leaned back, "it was the middle of the day, and they were smack in the middle of Amray's town square. Quoth was about to call for the constable, but he always had his eyes wide open, you see, and so he noticed that this fellow had white, white teeth.
The boy's eyes grew wide. He was a sweet eater?
Cobb nodded. And even worse, the fellow was starting to sweat like a hard-run horse. His eyes were wild, and his hands...
Cobb widened his own eyes and held out his hands, making them tremble.
So Quoth knew the fellow had the hunger, something fierce. And that meant he'd stab his own mum for a bent penny.
Cobb took another long drink, drawing out the tension.
Whatever did he do?
Bast burst out anxiously from the far end of the bar, wringing his hands dramatically. The innkeeper glared at his student.
Cobb continued. Well, first he hesitates. Then the man comes closer with the knife, and Quoth can see the fellow ain't going to ask again. So Quoth uses a dark magic that he found locked away in a secret book in the university. He speaks three terrible secret words and calls up a demon.
A demon?
The prentice's voice was almost a yelp.
Was it like the one?
Cobb shook his head slowly.
Oh, no. This one weren't spiderly at all. It was worse. This one was made all of shadows, and when it landed on the fellow, it bit him on the chest, right over his heart, and it drank all the blood out of him like you'd suck the juice out of a plum.
Black in hands, Cobb, Carter said, his voice thick with reproach. You're going to give the boy nightmares. He'll be carrying around that damn iron stick for a year with all your nonsense stuffed in his head.
That's not how I heard it, Graham said slowly. I heard there was a woman trapped in a burning house, and Quoth called up a demon to protect him from the fire. Then he ran inside and pulled the lady out of the fire, and she wasn't burned at all.
Listen to yourselves, Jake said disgusted. You're like kids at midwinter. Demon stole my doll. Demon spilled the milk.
Quoth didn't meddle with demons. He was at the university learning all manner of names, right? The fellow came at him with a knife, and he called out fire and lightning, just like Taberlin the Great.
It was a demon, Jake, Cobb said angrily. Otherwise, the story don't make a lick of sense. It was a demon he called up, and it drank up the fellow's blood, and everyone who saw was powerful shook up by it. Someone told a priest. Then the priest went to the constable, and the constable went and pulled him out of the widow's inn that night. Then they slapped him into jail for consorting with dark forces and such.
Folk probably just saw the fire and thought it was a demon, Jake persisted. You know how folk are.
No, I don't, Jacob,
Cobb snapped, crossing his arms in front of his chest and leaning back against the bar.
Why don't you tell me how folk are? Why don't you just go ahead and tell this whole damn story while...
Cobb stopped at the sound of heavy boots clumping on the wooden landing outside. After a pause, someone fumbled with the latch. Everyone turned around to look at the door, curious, as all the regular customers were already there.
Two new faces in one day,
Graham said gently, knowing he was touching on a delicate subject.
Looks like your dry spell might be over, Coat.
Roads must be getting better, Shep said into his drink, a hint of relief in his voice. About time we got a touch of luck.
The latch clicked, and the door swung slowly open, moving in a slow arc until it struck the wall. A man stood outside in the dark, as if deciding whether or not to come in.
Welcome to the Waystone, the innkeeper called out from behind the bar. What can we do for you?
The man stepped into the light, and the farmer's excitement was smothered by the sight of the piecemeal leather armor and heavy sword that marked a mercenary. A lone mercenary was never reassuring, even in the best of times. Everyone knew that the difference between an unemployed mercenary and a highwayman was mostly one of timing. What's more, it was obvious this mercenary had fallen on hard times. Brown Burr clung thick to the bottoms of his pants and the rough leather of his boots' laces. His shirt was fine linen dyed a deep royal blue, but mud-spattered and bramble-torn.
His hair was a greasy snarl. His eyes were dark and sunken, as if he hadn't slept in days. He moved a few steps farther into the inn, leaving the door open behind him.
"Looks like you've been on the road a while," Quoth said cheerily. "Would you like a drink or some dinner?"
When the mercenary made no reply, he added,
"None of us would blame you if you wanted to catch a bit of sleep first, either. It looks like you've had a rough couple days."
Quoth glanced at Bast, who slid off his stool and went to close the inn's front door. After slowly looking over everyone sitting at the bar, the mercenary moved to the empty space between Chronicler and Old Cobb. Quoth gave his best innkeeper smile as the mercenary leaned heavily against the bar and mumbled something. Across the room, Bast froze with his hand on the door handle.
"Beg your pardon?"
Quoth asked, leaning forward. The mercenary looked up, his eyes meeting Quoth's, then sweeping back and forth behind the bar. His eyes moved sluggishly, as if he'd been addled by a blow to the head.
"Aethan say, disguise Caven they."
Quoth leaned forward. "I'm sorry, what was that again?" When nothing was forthcoming from the mercenary, he looked around at the other men at the bar. "Did anyone catch that?" Chronicler was looking the mercenary over, eyeing the man's armor, the empty quiver of arrows, his fine blue linen shirt. The scribe's stare was intense, but the mercenary didn't seem to notice.
"It's Yaru," Cobb said knowingly. "Funny. You don't look like a shim."
Shep laughed, shaking his head. "Nah, he's drunk. My uncle used to talk like that." He nudged Graham with an elbow. "You remember my Uncle Tam? God, I've never known a man who drank like that."
Bast made a frantic, covert gesture from where he stood near the door, but Quoth was busy trying to catch the mercenary's eye.
"Speak Aeturin?" Quoth asked slowly. "What do you want?"
The mercenary's eyes rested momentarily on the innkeeper.
"Avoy,"
he began, then closed his eyes and tilted his head as if listening. He opened his eyes again.
"I want,"
he began, his voice slow and thick.
"I look."
He trailed off, his gaze wandering aimlessly around the room, his eyes unfocused.
"I know him," Chronicler said.
Everyone turned to look at the scribe.
"What?"
Shep asked. Chronicler's expression was angry.
"This fellow and four of his friends robbed me about 5 days ago. I didn't recognize him at first. He was clean-shaven then, but it's him!"
Behind the man's back, Bast made a more urgent gesture, trying to catch his master's attention, but Quoth was intent on the befuddled man.
"Are you sure?"
Chronicler gave a hard, humorless laugh.
"He's wearing my shirt. Ruined it, too. Cost me a whole talent. I never even got a chance to wear it."
"Was he like this before?" Chronicler shook his head.
"Not at all. He was almost genteel, as highwaymen go. I had him pegged as a low-ranking officer before he deserted."
Bast gave up signaling.
"Reshi!"
he called out, a hint of desperation in his voice.
"Just a moment, Bast,"
Quoth said, as he tried to catch the stupefied mercenary's attention. He waved a hand in front of the man's face, snapped his fingers.
"Hello?"
The man's eyes followed Quoth's moving hand, but seemed oblivious to everything being said around him.
"I am look,"
he said slowly.
"I look."
"What?" Cobb demanded testily. "What are you looking for?"
"Looking,"
the mercenary echoed vaguely.
"I imagine he's looking to give me my horse back,"
Chronicler said calmly, as he took a half step closer to the man and grabbed the hilt of his sword. With a sudden motion, he yanked it free, or rather, he tried to. Instead of sliding easily free of its scabbard, it came halfway out and stuck.
No!
Bast cried from across the room. The mercenary stared vaguely at Chronicler, but made no attempt to stop him. Standing awkwardly, still gripping the hilt of the man's sword, the scribe tugged harder, and the sword pulled slowly free. The broad blade was mottled with dried blood and rust. Taking a step back, Chronicler regained his composure and leveled the sword at the mercenary.
"And my horse is just for starters. Afterward, I think he's looking to give me my money back and have a nice chat with the constable."
The mercenary looked at the point of the sword where it swayed unsteadily in front of his chest. His eyes followed the gently swaying motion for a long moment.
"Just leave him be!" Bast's voice was shrill. "Please!"
Cobb nodded.
"Boy's right, Devon. Fella's not right in his head. Don't go pointing that at him. He looks likely to pass out on top of it."
The mercenary absent-mindedly lifted a hand.
"I am looking,"
he said, brushing the sword aside as if it were a branch blocking his path. Chronicler sucked in a breath and jerked the sword away as the man's hand ran along the edge of the blade, drawing blood.
"See?" old Cobb said. "What I tell you? Sod's a danger to hisself."
The mercenary's head tilted to the side. He held up his hand, examining it. A slow trickle of dark blood made its way down his thumb, where it gathered and swelled for a moment before dripping onto the floor. The mercenary drew a deep breath through his nose, and his glassy, sunken eyes came into sudden, sharp focus. He smiled wide at Chronicler, all the vagueness gone from his expression.
"Tiverian, Aroy, Sethalaf Emela,"
he said in a deep voice. I don't follow you," Chronicler said, disconcerted. The man's smile fell away. His eyes hardened, grew angry.
"Te Tauren Skreolet, Amaun."
"I can't tell what you're saying," Chronicler said, "but I don't care for your tone."
He brought the sword back up between them, pointing at the man's chest. The mercenary looked down at the heavy notched blade, his forehead furrowing in confusion. Then, sudden understanding spread across his face, and the wide smile returned. He threw back his head and laughed. It was no human sound. It was wild and exulting, like a hawk's shrill cry. The mercenary brought up his injured hand and grabbed the tip of the sword, moving with such sudden speed that the metal rang dully with the contact. Still smiling, he tightened his grip, bowing the blade. Blood ran from his hand, down the sword's edge to patter onto the floor. Everyone in the room watched in stunned disbelief. The only sound was the faint grating of the mercenary's finger bones grinding against the bare edges of the blade. Looking Chronicler full in the face, the mercenary twisted his hand sharply, and the sword broke with a sound like a shattered bell. As Chronicler stared dumbly at the ruined weapon, the mercenary took a step forward and laid his empty hand lightly on the scribe's shoulder. Chronicler gave a choked scream and jerked away as if he had been jabbed with a hot poker. He swung the broken sword wildly, knocking the hand away and notching it deep into the meat of the mercenary's arm. The man's face showed no pain or fear, or any sign of awareness that he'd been wounded at all. Still holding the broken tip of the sword in his bloody hand, the mercenary took another step toward Chronicler. Then Bast was there, barreling into the mercenary with one shoulder, striking him with such force that the man's body shattered one of the heavy bar stools before slamming into the mahogany bar. Quick as a blink, Bast grabbed the mercenary's head with both hands and slammed it into the edge of the bar. Lips pulled back in a grimace, Bass drove the man's head viciously into the mahogany, once, twice. Then, as if Bast's action had startled everyone awake, chaos erupted in the room. Old Cobb pushed himself away from the bar, tipping his stool over as he backed away. Graham began shouting something about the constable. Jake tried to bolt for the door and tripped over Cobb's fallen stool, sprawling to the floor in a tangle. The smith's prentice grabbed for his iron rod and ended up knocking it to the floor, where it rolled in a wide arc and came to rest under a table. Bast gave a startled yelp and was thrown violently across the room to land on one of the heavy timber tables. It broke under his weight, and he lay sprawled in the wreckage, limp as a rag doll. The mercenary came to his feet, blood flowing freely down the left-hand side of his face. He seemed utterly unconcerned as he turned back to Chronicler, still holding the tip of the broken sword in his bleeding hand. Behind him, Shep picked up a knife from where it lay next to the half-eaten wheel of cheese. It was just a kitchen knife, its blade about a hand span long. Face grim, the farmer stepped close behind the mercenary and stabbed down hard, driving the whole of the short blade deep into the mercenary's body, where the shoulder meets the neck. Instead of collapsing, the mercenary spun around and lashed Shep across the face with the jagged edge of the sword. Blood sprayed, and Shep lifted his hands to his face. Then, moving so quickly it was little more than a twitch, the mercenary brought the piece of metal back around, burying it in the farmer's chest. Shep staggered backward against the bar, then collapsed to the floor with the broken end of the sword still jutting between his ribs. The mercenary reached up and curiously touched the handle of the knife lodged in his own neck. His expression more puzzled than angry. He tugged at it. When it didn't budge, he gave another wild, bird-like laugh. As the farmer lay gasping and bleeding on the floor, the mercenary's attention seemed to wander, as if he'd forgotten what he was doing. His eyes slowly wandered around the room, moving lazily past the broken tables, the black stone fireplace, the huge oak barrels. Finally, the mercenary's gaze came to rest on the red-haired man behind the bar. Quoth did not blanch or back away when the man's attention settled onto him. Their eyes met. The mercenary's eyes sharpened again, focusing on Quoth. The wide, humorless smile reappeared, made macabre by the blood running down his face.
"Te Athen Sethaloi,"
he demanded.
"Te Rinte."
With an almost casual motion, Quoth grabbed a dark bottle from the counter and flung it across the bar. It struck the mercenary in the mouth and shattered. The air filled with a sharp tang of elderberry, dousing the man's still grinning head and shoulders. Reaching out one hand, Quoth dipped a finger into the liquor that spattered the bar. He muttered something under his breath, his forehead furrowed in concentration. He stared intently at the bloody man standing on the other side of the bar. Nothing happened. The mercenary reached across the bar, catching hold of Quoth's sleeve. The innkeeper simply stood, and in that moment his expression held no fear, no anger or surprise. He only seemed weary, numb, and dismayed. Before the mercenary could get a grip on Quoth's arm, he staggered as Bast tackled him from behind. Bast managed to get one arm around the mercenary's neck while the other raked at the man's face. The mercenary let go of Quoth and laid both hands on the arm that circled his neck, trying to twist away. When the mercenary's hands touched him, Bast's face became a tight mask of pain. Teeth bared, he clawed wildly at the mercenary's eyes with his free hand. At the far end of the bar, the smith's prentice finally retrieved his iron rod from under the table and stretched to his full height. He charged over the fallen stools and strewn bodies on the floor. Bellowing, he lifted the iron rod high over one shoulder. Still clinging to the mercenary, Bast's eyes grew wide with sudden panic as he saw the smith's prentice approaching. He released his grip and backed away, his feet tangling in the wreckage of the broken barstool. Falling backward, he scuttled madly away from the both of them. Turning, the mercenary saw the tall boy charging. He smiled and stretched out a bloody hand. The motion was graceful, almost lazy. The smith's prentice swatted the arm away. When the iron bar struck him, the mercenary's smile fell away. He clutched at his arm, hissing and spitting like an angry cat. The boy swung the iron rod again, striking the mercenary squarely in the ribs. The force of it knocked him away from the bar, and he fell to his hands and knees, screaming like a slaughtered lamb. The smith's prentice grabbed the bar with both hands and brought it down across the mercenary's back like a man splitting wood. There was the grisly sound of bones cracking. The iron bar rang softly like a distant, fog-muffled bell. Back broken, The bloody man still tried to crawl toward the inn's door. His face was blank now, his mouth open in a low howl as constant and unthinking as the sound of wind through winter trees. The prentice struck again and again, swinging the heavy iron rod lightly as a willow switch. He scored a deep groove in the wooden floor, then broke a leg, an arm, more ribs. Still, the mercenary continued to claw his way toward the door, shrieking and moaning, sounding more animal than human. Finally, the boy landed a blow to the head, and the mercenary went limp. There was a moment of perfect quiet. Then the mercenary made a deep, wet coughing sound, and vomited up a foul fluid, thick as pitch and black as ink. It was some time before the boy stopped battering at the motionless corpse, and even when he did stop, he held the bar poised over one shoulder, panting raggedly and looking around wildly. As he slowly caught his breath, the sound of low prayers could be heard from the other side of the room where old Cobb crouched against the black stone of the fireplace. After a few minutes, even the praying stopped, and silence returned to the Waystone Inn. For the next several hours, the Waystone was the center of the town's attention. The common room was crowded, full of whispers, murmured questions, and broken sobbing. Folk with less curiosity, or more propriety, stayed outside, peering through the wide windows and gossiping over what they'd heard. There were no stories yet, just a roiling mass of rumor. The dead man was a bandit come to rob the inn. He'd come looking for revenge against Chronicler, who deflowered his sister off in Abbotsford. He was a woodsman gone rabid. He was an old acquaintance of the innkeeper, come to collect a debt. He was an ex-soldier, gone tabard mad while fighting the rebels off in Reykjavik. Jake and Carter made a point of the mercenary's smile, and while dinner addiction was a city problem, folk had still heard of the sweet-eaters here. Three-Finger Tom knew about these things. He'd soldiered under the old king nearly 30 years ago. He explained that with 4 grains of denna resin, a man could have his foot amputated without a twinge of pain. With 8 grains, he'd saw through the bone himself. With 12 grains, he'd go for a jog afterward, laughing and singing Tinker Tanner. Shep's body was covered with a blanket and prayed over by the priest. Later, the constable looked at it as well, but the man was clearly out of his depth, and was looking because he felt he should, rather than because he knew what to look for. The crowd began to thin after an hour or so. Shep's brothers showed up with a cart to collect the body. Their grim, red-eyed stares drove away most of the remaining spectators who were idling about. Still, there was much to be done. The constable tried to piece together what had happened from witnesses and the more opinionated onlookers. After hours of speculation, the story finally began to coalesce. Eventually, it was agreed that the man was a deserter and dinner addict come to their little town just in time to go crazy. It was clear to everyone that the smith's prentice had done the right thing, a brave thing, in fact. Still, the iron law demanded a trial, so there'd be one next month, when the quarter court came through these parts on its rounds. The constable went home to his wife and children. The priest took the mercenary's remains off to the church. Bast cleared the wrecked furniture away, stacking it near the door to be used as firewood. The innkeeper mopped the inn's hardwood floor 7 times until the water in the bucket no longer tinged red when he rinsed it out. Eventually, even the most dedicated gawkers drifted away, leaving the usual felling night crowd, -1. Jake, Cobb, and the rest made halting conversation, speaking of everything other than what had happened, clinging to the comfort of each other's company. One by one, exhaustion drove them out of the Waystone. Eventually, only the smith's prentice remained, looking down into the cup in his hands. The iron rod lay near his elbow on the top of the mahogany bar. Nearly 30 minutes passed without anyone speaking. Chronicler sat at a nearby table, making a pretense of finishing a bowl of stew. Quoth and Bast puttered about, trying to look busy. A vague tension built in the room as they snuck glances at each other, waiting for the boy to leave. The innkeeper strolled over to the boy, wiping his hands on a clean linen cloth. "Well, boy, I guess—" "Aaron,"
the smith's apprentice interjected, not looking up from his drink. "My name's Aaron." Quoth nodded seriously.
"Aaron, then. I suppose you deserve that."
"I don't think it was Denner,"
Aaron said abruptly. Quoth paused. "Beg your pardon?"
"I don't think that fellow was a sweet eater."
"You with Cobb, then?" Quoth asked. "Think he was rabid?"
"I think he had a demon in him," the boy said with careful deliberation, as if he'd been thinking about the words for a long time. "I didn't say anything before, 'cause I didn't want folk to think I'd gone all cracked in the head like Crazy Martin."
He looked up from his drink.
"But I still think he had a demon in him."
Quoth put on a gentle smile and gestured to Bast and Chronicler. "Aren't you worried we'll think the same?" Aaron shook his head seriously.
"You aren't from around here. You've been places. You know what sort of things are out in the world." He gave Quoth a flat look. "I figure you know it was a demon, too."
Bast grew still where he stood sweeping near the hearth. Quoth tilted his head curiously without looking away.
"Why would you say that?"
The smith's apprentice gestured behind the bar.
"I know you got a big oak drunk thumper under the bar there, and well..."
His eyes flickered upward to the sword hanging menacingly behind the bar.
"There's only one reason I can think you'd grab a bottle instead of that. You weren't trying to knock that fellow's teeth in. You were going to light him on fire, except you didn't have any matches, and there weren't any candles close by. My ma used to read to me from the Book of the Path," he continued. "There's plenty of demons in there. Some hide in men's bodies like we'd hide under a sheepskin. I think he was just some regular fella who'd got a demon inside him. That's why nothing hurt him. He'd be like somebody poking holes in your shirt. That's why he didn't make no sense, either. He was talking demon talk."
Aaron's eyes slid back to the cup he held in his hands, nodding to himself.
"The more I think, the better it makes sense. Iron and fire, that's for demons."
"Sweet eaters are stronger than you'd think," Bast said from across the room.
"Once I saw..."
"You're right," Quoth said. "It was a demon." Aaron looked up to meet Quoth's eyes, then nodded and looked down into his mug again.
"And you didn't say anything because you're new in town and business is shy enough."
Quoth nodded.
"And it won't do me any good to tell folk, will it?"
Quoth drew a deep breath, then let it out slow.
"Probably not."
Aaron drank off the last swallow of his beer and pushed the empty mug away from himself on the bar.
"All right. I just needed to hear it. Needed to know I hadn't gone all crazy."
He came to his feet and picked up the heavy iron rod with one hand, resting it on his shoulder as he turned toward the door. No one spoke as he made his way across the room and let himself out, closing the door behind him. His heavy boots sounded hollowly on the wooden landing outside. Then there was nothing.
"There's more to that one than I would have guessed," Quoth said at last.
"It's because he's big," Bast said matter-of-factly as he gave up the pretense of sweeping. "You people are easily confused by the look of things. I've had my eye on him for a while now. He's cleverer than folk give him credit for, always looking at things and asking questions." He carried the broom back toward the bar. "He makes me nervous."
Quoth looked amused.
"Nervous? You?"
"The boy reeks of iron. Spends all day handling it, baking it, breathing its smoke, then comes in here with clever eyes."
Bast gave a profoundly disapproving look.
"It's not natural."
"Natural?" Chronicler finally spoke up. There was a tinge of hysteria in his voice. "What do you know about natural? I just saw a demon kill a man. Was that natural?" Chronicler turned to face Quoth. "What the hell was that thing doing here anyway?" Chronicler asked.
"Looking,
apparently," Quoth said. "That's about all I got. How about you, Bast? Could you understand it?"
Bast shook his head. I recognized the sound more than anything, Reshi. Its phrasing was very old, archaic. I couldn't make heads or tails of it.
Fine, it was looking, Chronicler said abruptly. Looking for what?
Me, probably, Kvothe said grimly.
Reshi,
Bast admonished him.
You're just being maudlin. This isn't your fault.
Kvothe gave his student a long, weary look. You know better than that, Bast. All of this is my fault. The Skrail, the war, all my fault.
Bast looked like he wanted to protest, but couldn't find the words. After a long moment, he looked away, beaten.
Kvothe leaned his elbows onto the bar, sighing.
What do you think it was, anyway?
Bast shook his head. It seemed like one of the Mahael Uret, Reshi. A skin dancer. He frowned as he said it, sounding anything but certain. Kvothe raised an eyebrow. It isn't one of your kind?
Bast's normally affable expression sharpened into a glare.
It was not my kind, he said indignantly. The male doesn't even share a border with us. It's as far away as anywhere can be in the Fae.
Kvothe nodded, a hint of an apology.
I just assumed you knew what it was. You didn't hesitate to attack it.
All snakes bite, Reshi. I don't need to know their names to know they're dangerous. I recognized it as being from the male. That was enough.
So, probably a skin dancer, Kvothe mused.
Didn't you tell me they'd been gone for ages and ages?
Bast nodded.
And it seemed sort of dumb, and it didn't try to escape into a new body, Bast shrugged.
Plus, we're all still alive. That seems to indicate that it was something else.
Chronicler watched the conversation incredulously.
You mean neither of you know what it was?
He looked at Kvothe.
You told the boy it was a demon!
For the boy, it is a demon, Kvothe said, because that's the easiest thing for him to understand, and it's close enough to the truth. He began to slowly polish the bar. For everyone else in town, it's a sweet eater, because that will let them get some sleep tonight.
Well, it's a demon for me too, then, Chronicler said sharply, because my shoulder feels like ice when it touched me.
Bast hurried over. I forgot it got a hand on you. Let me see.
Kvothe closed the window's shutters while Chronicler removed his shirt.
There were bandages stripping the backs of his arms from where he had been wounded by the Skrail 3 nights ago.
Bast looked closely at his shoulder.
Can you move it?
Chronicler nodded, rolling it around.
It hurt like 12 bastards when he touched me, like something was tearing up inside.
He shook his head in irritation at his own description.
Now it just feels strange, numb, like it's asleep.
Bast prodded his shoulder with a finger, looking it over dubiously.
Chronicler looked back at Kvothe. The boy was right about the fire, wasn't he? Until he mentioned it, I didn't under—
Ah! The scribe shouted, jerking away from Bast. What in God's name was that? He demanded.
Your brachial nerve plexus, I'm guessing, Kvothe said dryly.
I needed to see how deep the damage went, Bast said unruffled. Reshi, would you get me some goose grease, garlic, mustard? Do we have any of those green things that smell like onions but aren't?
Kvothe nodded.
Caverol? I think there's a few left.
Bring them, and a bandage, too. I should get a salve on this.
Kvothe nodded and stepped through the doorway behind the bar. As soon as he was out of sight, Bast leaned close to Chronicler's ear.
Don't ask him about it, he hissed urgently.
Don't mention it at all.
Chronicler looked puzzled.
What are you talking about?
About the bottle. About the sympathy he tried to do.
So he was trying to light that thing on fire. Why didn't it work?
What's... Bast tightened his grip, his thumb digging into the hollow beneath Chronicler's collarbone. The scribe gave another startled yelp.
Don't talk about that,
Bast hissed in his ear.
Don't ask questions.
Holding both the scribe's shoulders, Bast shook him once, like an angry parent with a stubborn child.
"Good Lord, Bast, I can hear him howling all the way in the back," Quoth called from the kitchen.
Bast stood upright and pulled Chronicler straight in his chair as the innkeeper emerged from the doorway.
"Taylu, anyway, he's white as a sheet. Is he going to be okay?"
"It's about as serious as a frostburn," Bast said disparagingly. "It's not my fault if he screams like a little girl."
"Well, be careful with him," Quoth said, setting a pot of grease and a handful of garlic cloves on the table. "He'll need that arm for at least another couple days."
Quoth peeled and crushed the garlic. Bast mixed the salve and smeared the foul-smelling concoction onto the scribe's shoulder before wrapping a bandage around it. Chronicler sat very still.
"Do you feel up for a little more writing tonight?" Quoth asked, after the scribe was wearing his shirt again. "We're still days away from any true ending, but I can tie up a few loose ends before we call it a night."
"I'm good for hours yet." Chronicler hurried to unpack his satchel without so much as a glance in Bast's direction.
"Me too." Bast turned to face Quoth, his face bright and eager. "I want to know what you found under the university."
Quoth gave a shadow of a smile. "I supposed you would, Bast." He came to the table and took a seat. "Underneath the university, I found what I had wanted most, yet it was not what I expected." He motioned for Chronicler to pick up his pen. "As is often the case when you gain your heart's desire."
Chapter 89. A Pleasant Afternoon. The next day I was whipped in the wide cobblestone courtyard that used to be called Quoyen Hale, the House of the Wind. I found it oddly appropriate. As predicted, there was an impressive crowd for the event. Hundreds of students filled the courtyard to overflowing. They peered out of windows and doorways. A few even found their way onto the rooftops for a better view. I don't blame them, really. Free entertainment is hard to pass by. I was lashed 6 times, singly, across the back. Not wanting to disappoint, I gave them something to talk about, a repeat performance. I did not cry out, or bleed, or faint. I left the courtyard walking on my own 2 feet with my head held high. After Mola laid 57 tidy stitches across my back, I found consolation in a journey to Imre, where I spent Ambrose's money on an extraordinarily fine lute. 2 nice sets of used clothing for me, a small bottle of my own blood, and a warm, new dress for Ari. It was, all in all, a very pleasant afternoon.
Chapter 90. Half-Built Houses. Every night I went exploring underground with Ari. I saw many interesting things, some of which may bear mentioning later, but for now, suffice to say that she showed me all the vast and varied corners of the Underthing. She took me to Downings, Vaults, the Woods, Delving, Cricklet, Tenors, Candlebear. The names she gave them, nonsensical at first, fit like a glove when I finally saw what they described. The Woods didn't resemble a forest in any way. It was just a series of crumbling halls and rooms where ceilings were propped up with thick wooden support beams. Cricklet had a tiny trickle of fresh water running down one wall. The moisture attracted crickets, who filled the long, low room with their tiny songs. Vaults was a narrow hallway with 3 deep cracks running across the floor. I only understood the name after watching Ari jump all 3 in quick succession to make it to the other end. It was several days before Ari took me to Below's, a maze of intersecting tunnels. Despite the fact that we were at least 100 feet below ground, they were filled with a steady, rushing wind that smelled of dust and leather. The wind was the clue I needed. It let me know I was close to finding what I'd come here looking for. Still, it bothered me that I didn't understand the name of this place. I knew I must be missing something.
"Why do you call this Below's?" I asked Ari.
"That's its name," she said easily. The wind made her fine hair stream out behind her like a gauzy pennant. "You call things by their names. That's what names are for." I smiled despite myself.
"Why does it have that name?
Isn't everything here below?" She turned to look at me,
head cocked to one side. Her hair blew around her face, and she brushed it back with her hands.
"It's not Belows," she said. "It's Belows."
I couldn't hear the distinction.
"Blows?" I asked, puffing out my cheeks as if blowing out air.
Ari laughed, delighted.
"That's a piece," she grinned.
"Try for more." I tried to think of what else made sense.
"Bellows?"
I made a gesture with both arms as if working a forge bellows. Ari thought about that for a moment, looking up and tilting her head back and forth.
"That's not as good. This is a quiet place."
She reached out a small hand and took hold of the edge of my cloak, pulling it out to the side so the slow wind caught it, filling it like a sail. Ari looked up at me, grinning as if she'd just done a magic trick.
"Belows, of course,"
I grinned back, laughing. That minor mystery put to rest, Ari and I began a meticulous investigation of Belows. After several hours, I began to get a feel for the place, an understanding of which way I needed to go. It was just a matter of finding the tunnel that led there. It was maddening. The tunnels twisted, leading in wide, unhelpful detours. Those rare times when I found a tunnel that stayed true to its course, the way was blocked. Several passages turned straight up or straight down, leaving me with no way to follow them. One passage had thick iron bars driven deep into the surrounding stone, blocking the way. Another grew steadily narrower until it was barely a handspan across. A third ended with a cave-in of tangled wood and soil. After days of searching, we finally found an ancient, moldering door. The damp wood crumbled to pieces when I tried to open it. Ari wrinkled her nose and shook her head.
"I'll skin my knees."
Shining my sympathy lamp past the ruined door, I saw what she meant. The room beyond slanted down until the ceiling was only 3 feet high.
"Will you wait for me?"
I asked her as I took off my cloak and cuffed up my shirt sleeves. "I don't know if I can find my way up to the top without you." Ari nodded, looking worried.
"Ins are easier than outs, you know. There's tight places. You can get stuck."
I was trying not to think of that.
"I'm just going for a look. I'll be back in half an hour."
She cocked her head.
"What if you're not?"
I smiled.
"You'll have to come and rescue me."
She nodded, her face as solemn as an earnest child. I put my sympathy lamp in my mouth, shining the red light out against the pitch blackness in front of me. Then I got down on all fours and headed forward, my knees rubbing against the rough stone of the floor. After several turnings, the ceiling went lower still, too low for crawling. After a long moment of consideration, I dropped to my belly and pressed on, pushing my lamp ahead of me. Each twist of my body pulled at the rows of stitches all across my back. If you have never been deep underground, I doubt you can understand what it is like. The darkness is absolute, almost tangible. It lurks outside the light, waiting to rush in like a sudden flood. The air is still and stale. There's no noise except what you make yourself. Your breathing becomes loud in your own ears. Your heart thumps. And all the while, there is the overwhelming knowledge that thousands of tons of earth and stone are pressing down above you. Still, I continued to worm my way ahead, moving by inches. My hands were grimy, and sweat dripped into my eyes. The crawlway grew smaller yet, and I foolishly let one of my arms get pinned to my side. Cold sweat burst out across my whole body as I panicked. I struggled, trying to get it stretched out in front of me. After several terrifying minutes, I managed to get my arm free. Then, after lying there for a moment, trembling in the dark, I pressed ahead and found what I'd been looking for. After emerging from the underthing, I made my careful way through a window and a locked door into the women's wing of the mews. I knocked softly on Fella's door, not wanting to wake anyone accidentally. Men are not allowed unescorted in the women's wing of the mews, especially not during the late hours of night. I knocked 3 times before I heard a gentle stirring in her room. After a moment,
Fella opened the door, her long hair in wild disarray. Her eyes were still half-closed as she peered into the hallway with a puzzled expression. She blinked when she saw me standing there, as if she hadn't really expected anyone. She was unmistakably naked, with a bedsheet half-wrapped around herself. I will admit that the sight of gorgeous, full-breasted Fella half-naked in front of me was one of the most startlingly erotic moments in my young life. "Quoth?" she said, maintaining a remarkable degree of composure. She tried to cover herself more fully and met with mixed success, pulling the sheet up to her neck in exchange for exposing a scandalous amount of long, shapely leg. "What time is it? How did you get in here?" "You said that if I ever needed anything, I could call on you for a favor," I said urgently. "Did you mean it?"
"Well, yes, of course," she said. "God, you're a mess. What happened to you?"
I looked down at myself, only then realizing the state I was in. I was grimy, the front of my body streaked with dirt from sliding across the floor. I'd torn open my pants across one knee, and it looked like I was bleeding underneath. I'd been so excited that I hadn't even noticed or thought to change into my new clothes before I came. Fella took a half step back and swung the door wider, making room for me to enter. As it opened, the door made a tiny wind that pressed the sheet against her body, outlining her nudity in perfect profile for a moment.
"Do you need to come in?"
"I can't stay," I said without thinking, struggling against the urge to gawk openly. "I need you to meet a friend of mine in the archives tomorrow evening. Fifth bell, by the four-plate door. Can you do that?"
"I have class," she said. "But if it's important, I can skip it."
"Thank you," I said quietly as I backed away. It says a great deal about what I had found in the tunnels underneath the university that I was halfway back to my room at Anchor's before I realized I had turned down an invitation from a near-naked fella to join her in her room. The next day, Fella skipped her lecture on advanced geometries and made her way to the archives. She climbed down several flights of stairs and through a maze of corridors and shelves to find the only section of stone wall in the entire building that wasn't lined with books. The four-plate door stood there, silent and immobile as a mountain. Veleritas. Fella looked around nervously, shifting her weight from foot to foot. After a long moment, a hooded figure stepped out of the dark and into the ruddy light of her hand lamp. She smiled anxiously.
"Hello," she said softly. "A friend asked me to..."
She paused and ducked her head a little, trying to glimpse the face under the shadow of the hood. You probably wouldn't be surprised at who she saw.
"Quoth?"
she said incredulously, looking around in sudden panic.
"My God, what are you doing in here?"
"Trespassing," I said flippantly. She grabbed hold of me and pulled me through a maze of shelves until we came to one of the reading holes scattered throughout the archives. She pushed me in and closed the door firmly behind us and leaned against it.
"How did you get in here? Lorne will burst a vessel. Do you want to get us both expelled?"
"They wouldn't expel you," I said easily. "You're guilty of willful collusion at the very most. They can't expel you for that. You'd probably get off with a fine, since they don't whip women." I shifted my shoulders a little, feeling the dull tug of the stitches across my back, which seems a little unfair if you ask me.
"How did you get in here?" she repeated. "Did you sneak past the desk?"
"You're better off not knowing," I hedged. It had been Billows, of course. Once I smelled old leather and dust on the wind there, I knew I was close. Hidden away in the maze of tunnels was a door that led directly into the lowest level of the stacks. It was there so the Scrivs would have easy access to the ventilation system. The door had been locked, of course, but locked doors have never proved much of a hindrance to me, more's the pity. I didn't tell Fella any of that, however. I knew my secret route would only work as long as it remained secret. Telling a Scriv, even a Scriv who owed me a favor, simply wasn't a good idea. "Listen," I said quickly, "it's safe as houses. I've been here for hours, and no one's come even close to me. Everyone carries their own light, so it's easy to avoid them." "You just surprised me," Fella said, as she brushed her dark hair back over her shoulders. "You're right, though. It's probably safer out there. She opened the door and peered outside, making sure the coast was clear. Scriv spot-checked the reading holes periodically to make sure no one's sleeping in here or having sex.
What?
There's a lot you don't know about the archives, she smiled as she opened the door the rest of the way. That's why I need your help, I said as we headed out into the stacks. I can't make heads or tails of this place. What are you looking for? Fella asked. About 1,000 things, I said honestly. But we can start with the history of the Aemir, or any non-fictional reports of the Chandrian. Anything about either one, really. I haven't been able to find a thing. I didn't bother trying to keep the frustration from my voice. To finally get inside the archives after all this time and not be able to find any of the answers I was looking for was maddening. I thought things would be better organized, I groused. Fella chuckled deep in her throat. And how would you do that, exactly? Organize everything, I mean. I've been thinking about it for the last couple hours, actually, I said. It'd be best to do it by subject. You know, histories, memoirs, grammars. Fella stopped walking and gave a deep sigh. I guess we should get this over with. She pulled a slim book off the shelf at random. What's the subject of this book? I opened it and glanced over the pages. It was written in an old scribe's hand, spidery and hard to follow. It looks like a memoir. What type of memoir? Where do you put it in relationship to the other memoirs? Still flipping pages, I spotted a carefully drawn map. Actually, it looks more like a travelogue. Fine, she said. Where do you put it in the memoir travelogue section? I'd organize them geographically, I said, enjoying the game. I flipped more pages. Aetor, Modeg, and... Vint? I frowned and looked at the spine of the book. How old is this? The Aeturan Empire absorbed Vint over 300 years ago. Over 400 years, she corrected. So where do you put a travelogue that refers to a place that doesn't exist anymore? It would be more of a history, really, I said more slowly. What if it isn't accurate? Fella pressed. Based on hearsay rather than personal experience? What if it's purely fictional? Novel travelogues were quite a fashion in Modeg a couple hundred years ago. I closed the book and slowly slid it back onto the shelf. I'm beginning to see the problem, I said thoughtfully. No, you don't, Fella said frankly. You're just glimpsing the edges of the problem. She gestured to the stacks around us. Let's say you became Master Archivist tomorrow. How long would it take you to organize all of this? I looked around at the countless shelves retreating off into the darkness. It would be a lifetime's work. Evidence suggests it takes more than just one lifetime, Fella said dryly. There are over 750,000 volumes here, and that's not even taking into consideration the clays or scrolls or fragments from Kelebtena. She made a dismissive gesture. So you spend years developing the perfect organizational system, which even has a convenient place for your historical, fictional travelogue memoir. You and the Scribs spend decades slowly identifying, sorting, and reordering tens of thousands of books. She looked me in the eye. And then you die. What happens then? I began to see where she was going. Well, in a perfect world, the next Master Archivist would pick up where I left off, I said. Hurrah for the perfect world! Fella said sarcastically, then turned and began leading me through the shelves again. I'm guessing the new Master Archivist usually has his own ideas about how to organize things. Not usually, Fella admitted. Sometimes there are several in a row who work toward the same system, but sooner or later you get someone who's sure they have a better way of doing things, and everything starts from scratch again. How many different systems have there been? I spotted a faint red light bobbing in the distant shelves and pointed toward it. Fella changed directions to take us away from the light and whoever was carrying it. It depends on how you count them, she said softly. At least 9 in the last 300 years. The worst was about 50 years ago when there were 4 new master archivists within 5 years of each other. The result was 3 different factions among the Scribs, each using a different cataloging system. Each firmly believing theirs was the best. Sounds like a civil war, I said.
a holy war, Fella said. A very quiet, circumspect crusade where each side was sure they were protecting the immortal soul of the archives. They would steal books that had already been catalogued in each other's systems. They would hide books from each other, or confuse their order on the shelves. How long did this go on? Almost 15 years, Fella said. It might still be going on today if Master Tolem Scrivs hadn't finally managed to steal the Larkin Ledger books and burn them. The Larkins couldn't keep going after that.
And the moral of the story is that people get passionate around books, I teased gently. Hence the need to spot-check the reading holes. Fella stuck out her tongue at me.
The moral of the story is that things are a mess in here. We effectively lost almost 200,000 books when Tolem burned the Larkin ledgers. They were the only records on where those books were located. Then, 5 years later, Tolem dies. Guess what happens then?
A new master archivist looking to start over with a clean slate?
It's like an endless chain of half-built houses, she said, exasperated. It's easy to find books in the old system, so that's how they built the new system. Whoever's working on the new house keeps stealing lumber from what's been built before. The old systems are still there in scattered bits and pieces. We're still finding pockets of books Scrivs hid from each other years ago.
I sense this is a sore spot with you, I said with a smile.
We reached a flight of stairs and Fella turned to look at me. It's a sore spot with every Scriv who lasts more than 2 days working in the archives, she said. People down in the tomes complain when it takes us an hour to bring them what they want. They don't realize it's not as easy as going to the Amir history shelf and pulling down a book. She turned and began to climb the stairs. I followed her silently, appreciating the new perspective.
Chapter 91. Worthy of Pursuit. Fall term settled into a comfortable pattern after that. Fella slowly introduced me to the inner workings of the archives, and I spent what time I could spare skulking about, trying to dig up answers to my 1,000 questions. Elodin did something that could conceivably be referred to as teaching, but for the most part, he seemed more interested in confusing me than shedding any real light on the subject of naming. My progress was so non-existent that I wondered at times if there was any progress to be made at all. What time I didn't spend studying or in the archives, I spent on the road to Imre, braving the coming winter wind, if not looking for its name. The Aeolian was always my best bet for finding Denna, and as the weather worsened, I found her there more and more. By the time the first snow fell, I usually managed to catch her one trip of three. Unfortunately, I rarely managed to have her wholly to myself, as she usually had someone with her. As Diak had mentioned, she was not the sort who spent a lot of time alone. Still, I kept coming. Why? Because whenever she saw me, some light would go on inside her, making her glow for a moment. She would jump to her feet, run to me, and catch hold of my arm, then, smiling, bring me back to her table and introduce me to her newest man. I came to know most of them. None were good enough for her. So I held them in contempt and hated them. They in turn hated and feared me. But we were pleasant to each other. Always pleasant. It was a game of sorts. He would invite me to sit, and I would buy him a drink. The three of us would talk, and his eyes would slowly grow dark as he watched her smile toward me. His mouth would narrow as he listened to the laughter that leaped from her as I joked, spun stories, sang. They would always react the same way, trying to prove ownership of her in small ways, holding her hand, a kiss, a too casual touch along her shoulder. They clung to her with desperate determination. Some of them merely resented my presence, saw me as a rival. But others had a frightened knowledge buried deep behind their eyes from the beginning. They knew she was leaving, and they didn't know why. So they clutched at her like shipwrecked sailors, clinging to the rocks, despite the fact that they are being battered to death against them. I almost felt sorry for them. Almost. So they hated me, and it shone in their eyes when Denna wasn't looking.
I would offer to buy another round of drinks, but he would insist, and I would graciously accept, and thank him, and smile.
I have known her longer, my smile said. True, you have been inside the circle of her arms, tasted her mouth, felt the warmth of her, and that is something I have never had. But there is a part of her that is only for me. You cannot touch it, no matter how hard you might try. And after she has left you, I will still be here, making her laugh, my light shining in her. I will still be here long after she has forgotten your name. There were more than a few. She went through them like a pen through wet paper. She left them disappointed, or frustrated they abandoned her, leaving her heart sore, moved to sadness, but never as far as tears. There were tears once or twice, but they were not for the men she had lost or the men she had left. They were quiet tears for herself, because there was something inside her that was badly hurt. I couldn't tell what it was and didn't dare to ask. Instead, I simply said what I could to take the pain away and helped her shut her eyes against the world. Occasionally, I would talk about Denna with Willem and Simon. Being true friends, they gave me sensible advice and compassionate sympathy in roughly equal amounts. The compassion I appreciated, but the advice was worse than useless. They urged me toward the truth, told me to open my heart to her, to pursue her, write her poetry, send her roses. Roses. They didn't know her, despite the fact that I hated them. Denna's men taught me a lesson that I might never have learned otherwise. What you don't understand, I explained to Simon one afternoon as we sat under the pennant pole, is that men fall for Denna all the time. Do you know what that's like for her? How tiresome it is? I am one of her few friends. I won't risk that. I won't throw myself at her. She doesn't want it. I will not be one of the 100 cow-eyed suitors who go mooning after her like love-struck sheep. I just don't understand what you see in her, Sim said carefully. I know she's charming, fascinating and all of that, but she seems rather, he hesitated, cruel. I nodded. She is. Simon watched me expectantly, finally said, what? No defense for her? No. Cruel is a good word for her, but I think you're saying cruel and thinking something else. Denna is not wicked or mean or spiteful. She is cruel. Sim was quiet for a long while before responding. I think she might be some of those other things, and cruel as well. Good, honest, gentle Sim. He could never bring himself to say bad things about another person, just imply them. Even that was hard for him. He looked up at me. I talked with Savoy. He's still not over her. He really loved her, you know. Treated her like a princess. He would have done anything for her. But she left him anyway. No explanation. Denna is a wild thing, I explained. Like a hind or a summer storm. If a storm blows down your house or breaks a tree, you don't say the storm was mean. It was cruel. It acted according to its nature, and something unfortunately was hurt. The same is true of Denna. What's a hind? A deer. I thought that was a hart. A hind is a female deer. A wild deer. Do you know how much good it does to chase a wild thing? None. It works against you. It startles the hind away. All you can do is stay gently where you are and hope in time that the hind will come to you. Sim nodded, but I could tell he didn't really understand. Did you know they used to call this place the Questioning Hall? I said, pointedly changing the subject. Students would write questions on slips of paper and let the wind blow them around. You would get different answers depending on the way the paper left the square. I gestured to the gaps between the gray buildings Elodin had shown to me. Yes, no, maybe, elsewhere, soon. The belling tower struck, and Simon sighed, sensing it was pointless to pursue the conversation further. Are we playing corners tonight? I nodded. After he was gone,
I reached into my cloak and pulled out the note Denna had left in my window. I read it again, slowly, then carefully tore away the bottom of the page where she had signed it. I folded the narrow strip of paper with Denna's name, twisted it, and let the courtyard's ever-present wind tug it out of my hand to spin among the few remaining autumn leaves. It danced along the cobblestones. It circled and spun, making patterns too wild and varied for me to understand. But though I waited until the sky grew dark, the wind never took it away. When I left, my question was still wandering in the house of the wind, giving no answers, hinting at many. Yes, no, maybe, elsewhere, soon. Lastly, there was my ongoing feud with Ambrose. I walked on pins and needles every day, waiting for him to take his revenge. But the months passed, and nothing happened. Eventually, I came to the conclusion that he had finally learned his lesson and was keeping a safe distance from me. I was wrong, of course, perfectly and completely wrong. Ambrose had merely learned to bide his time. He did manage to get his revenge, and when it came, I was caught flat-footed and forced to leave the university. But that, as they say, is a story for another day. Chapter 92. The Music That Plays. "That should do for now, I imagine," Kvothe said, gesturing for Chronicler to lay down his pen. "We have all the groundwork now, a foundation of story to build upon." Kvothe came to his feet and rolled his shoulders, stretching his back. "Tomorrow we'll have some of my favorite stories. My journey to Alvaran's court, learning to fight from the Adem. Felurian." He picked up a clean linen cloth and turned to Chronicler. "Is there anything you need before you turn in for the night?" Chronicler shook his head, knowing a polite dismissal when he heard one. "Thank you, no, I'll be fine." He gathered everything into his flat leather satchel and made his way upstairs to his rooms. "You too, Bast," Kvothe said. "I'll take care of the cleaning up." He made a shooing motion to forestall his student's protest. "Go on. I need time to think about tomorrow's story. These things don't plan themselves, you know." Shrugging, Bast headed up the stairs as well, his footsteps sounding hard on the wooden stairs. Kvothe went about his nightly ritual. He shoveled ashes out of the huge stone fireplace and brought in wood for tomorrow's fire. He went outside to extinguish the lamps beside the Waystone's sign, only to find that he'd forgotten to light them earlier that evening. He locked the inn, and after a moment's consideration, left the key in the door so Chronicler could let himself out if he woke early in the morning. Then he swept the floor, washed the tables, and rubbed down the bar, moving with a methodical efficiency. Last came the polishing of the bottles. As he went through the motions, his eyes were far away, remembering. He did not hum or whistle. He did not sing. In his room, Chronicler moved about restlessly, tired but too full of anxious energy to let sleep take him. He removed the finished pages from his satchel and stowed them safely in the heavy wooden chest of drawers. Then he cleaned all his pen's nibs and set them out to dry. He carefully removed the bandage on his shoulder, threw the foul-smelling thing in the chamber pot, and replaced the lid before washing his shoulder clean in the hand basin. Yawning, he went to the window and looked out at the little town, but there was nothing to see. No lights, no movement. He opened the window a crack, letting in the fresh autumn air. Drawing the curtains, Chronicler undressed for bed, lying his clothes over the back of a chair. Last of all, he removed the simple iron wheel from around his neck and laid it on the nightstand. Turning down his bed, Chronicler was surprised to see the sheets had been changed sometime during the day. The linen was crisp and smelled pleasantly of lavender. After a moment's hesitation, Chronicler moved to the door of his room and locked it. He laid the key on the nightstand, then frowned and picked up the stylized iron wheel and put it back around his neck before snuffing the lamp and crawling into bed. For the better part of an hour, Chronicler lay sleepless in his sweet-smelling bed, rolling restlessly from side to side. Finally, he sighed and threw off the covers. He relit the lamp with a sulfur match and climbed back out of bed. Then he walked over to the heavy chest of drawers beside the window and pushed at it. It wouldn't budge at first, but when he put his back into it, he managed to slide it slowly across the smooth wooden floor. After a minute, the weighty piece of furniture was pressed against the door of his room. Then he climbed back into bed, rolled down the lamp, and quickly fell into a deep and peaceful sleep. It was pitch black in the room when Chronicler woke with something soft pressing against his face. He thrashed wildly, more a reflex than an attempt to get away. His startled shout was muffled by the hand clamped firmly over his mouth. After his initial panic, Chronicler went quiet and limp. Breathing hard through his nose, he lay there, eyes wide in the darkness. "It's just me," Bast whispered without removing his hand. Chronicler said something muffled. "We need to talk." Kneeling beside the bed, Bast looked down at the dark shape Chronicler made, twisted in his blankets. "I'm going to light the lamp, and you're not going to make any loud noises, all right?" Chronicler nodded against Bast's hand. A moment later, a match flared, filling the room with jagged red light and the acrid smell of sulfur. Then gentler lamplight welled up. Bast licked his fingers and pinched the match between them. Trembling slightly, Chronicler sat up in the bed and put his back against the wall. Bare-chested, he gathered the blanket self-consciously around his waist and glanced toward the door. The heavy dresser was still in place. Bast followed his gaze. "That shows a certain lack of trust," he said dryly. "You better not have scratched up his floors. He gets mad as hell about that sort of thing." "How did you get in here?" Chronicler demanded. Bast flailed his hands frantically at Chronicler's head. "Quiet!" he hissed. "We have to be quiet. He has ears like a hawk." "How?" Chronicler began more softly, then stopped. "Hawks don't have ears." Bast gave him a puzzled look. "What? You said he has ears like a hawk. That doesn't make any sense." Bast frowned and made a dismissive gesture. "You know what I mean. He can't know that I'm here." Bast sat on the edge of the bed and smoothed down his pants self-consciously. Chronicler gripped the blankets bunched around his waist. "Why are you here?" "Like I said, we need to talk." Bast looked at Chronicler seriously. "We need to talk about why you're here." "This is what I do," Chronicler said, irritated. "I collect stories, and when I get the chance, I investigate odd rumors and see if there's any truth behind them." "Out of curiosity, which rumor was it?" Bast asked. "Apparently, you got soppy drunk and let something slip to a wagoneer," Chronicler said. "Rather careless, all things considered." Bast gave Chronicler a profoundly pitying look. "Look at me," Bast said, as if talking to a child. "Think. Could some wagon herder get me drunk? Me?" Chronicler opened his mouth, closed it. "Then?" "He was my message in a bottle. One of many. You just happened to be the first person to find one and come looking." Chronicler took a long moment to digest this piece of information. "I thought you two were hiding." "Oh, we're hiding all right," Bass said bitterly. "We're tucked away so safe and sound that he's practically fading into the woodwork." "I can understand you feeling a little stifled around here," Chronicler said, "but honestly, I don't see what your master's bad mood has to do with the price of butter." Bast's eyes flashed angrily. "It has everything to do with the price of butter," he said through his teeth. "And it's a damn sight more than a bad mood, you ignorant, wretched Anhout Fane! This place is killing him." Chronicler went pale at Bast's outburst. I'm not... Bast closed his eyes and drew a deep breath, obviously trying to calm himself. "You just don't understand what's going on," he said, speaking to himself as much as chronicler. That's why I came to explain. I've been waiting for months for someone to come. Anyone. Even old enemies come to settle scores would be better than him wasting away like this. But you're better than I'd hoped for. You're perfect.
Perfect for what? Chronicler asked. I don't even know what the problem is.
It's like... Have you ever heard the story of Martin Maskmaker?
Chronicler shook his head, and Bast gave a frustrated sigh.
How about plays? Have you seen The Ghost and the Goose Girl, or The Halfpenny King?
Chronicler frowned.
Is that the one where the king sells his crown to an orphan boy?
Bast nodded.
And the boy becomes a better king than the original. The Goose Girl dresses like a countess, and everyone is stunned by her grace and charm.
He hesitated, struggling to find the words he wanted.
You see, there's a fundamental connection between seeming and being. Every fae child knows this, but you mortals never seem to see. We understand how dangerous a mask can be. We all become what we pretend to be.
Chronicler relaxed a bit, sensing familiar ground.
That's basic psychology. You dress a beggar in fine clothes, people treat him like a noble, and he lives up to their expectations.
That's only the smallest piece of it, Bast said. The truth is deeper than that. It's... Bast floundered for a moment.
It's like everyone tells a story about themselves inside their own head. Always. All the time. That story makes you what you are. We build ourselves out of that story.
Frowning, Chronicler opened his mouth, but Bast held up a hand to stop him.
No, listen. I've got it now. You meet a girl. Shy, unassuming. If you tell her she's beautiful, she'll think you're sweet, but she won't believe you. She knows that beauty lies in your beholding.
Bast gave a grudging shrug. And sometimes that's enough.
His eyes brightened. But there's a better way. You show her she is beautiful. You make mirrors of your eyes, prayers of your hands against her body. It is hard, very hard, but when she truly believes you...
Bast gestured excitedly.
Suddenly, the story she tells herself in her own head changes. She transforms. She isn't seen as beautiful. She is beautiful seen.
What the hell is that supposed to mean? Chronicler snapped. You're just spouting nonsense now.
I'm spouting too much sense for you to understand,
Bast said testily.
But you're close enough to see my point. Think of what he said today. People saw him as a hero, and he played the part. He wore it like a mask, but eventually he believed it. It became the truth. But now, he trailed off.
Now people see him as an innkeeper, Chronicler said.
No, Bast said softly. People saw him as an innkeeper a year ago. He took off the mask when they walked out the door. Now he sees himself as an innkeeper, and a failed innkeeper at that. You saw what he was like when Cobb and the rest came in tonight. You saw that thin shadow of a man behind the bar tonight. It used to be an act.
Bast looked up excited.
But you're perfect. You can help him remember what it was like. I haven't seen him so lively in months. I know you can do it.
Chronicler frowned a bit.
I'm not sure.
I know it will work, Bast said eagerly. I tried something similar a couple of months ago.
I got him to start a memoir.
Chronicler perked up.
He wrote a memoir?
Started a memoir, Bast said.
He was so excited, talked about it for days, wondering where he should begin his story. After his first night's writing, he was like his old self again. He looked 3 feet taller with lightning on his shoulders.
Bast sighed.
But something happened. The next day he read what he'd written and went into one of his dark moods, claimed the whole thing was the worst idea he'd ever had.
What about the pages he wrote?
Bast made a crumpling motion with his hands and tossed imaginary paper away.
What did they say? Chronicler asked.
Bast shook his head. He didn't throw them away. He just threw them. They've been lying on his desk for months. Chronicler's curiosity was almost palpable. Can't you just... He waggled his fingers. You know, tidy them up. On Bowen. No. Bast looked horrified. He was furious after he read them. Bast shivered a little. You don't know what he's like when he's really angry. I know better than to cross him on something like that.
I suppose you know best, Chronicler said dubiously.
Bast gave an emphatic nod.
Exactly. That's why I came to talk to you, because I know best. You need to keep him from focusing on the dark things. If not...
Bast shrugged and repeated the motion of crumpling and throwing away a piece of paper.
But I'm collecting the story of his life. The real story.
Chronicler made a helpless gesture.
Without the dark parts, it's just some silly
Chronicler froze halfway through the word, eyes darting nervously to the side. Bast grinned like a child catching a priest mid-curse.
Go on,
he urged. His eyes were delighted and hard and terrible.
Say it.
Like some silly fairy story, Chronicler finished, his voice thin and pale as paper. Bast smiled a wide smile.
You know nothing of the Fae. If you think our stories lack their darker sides.
But all that aside, this is a fairy story, because you are gathering it for me. Chronicler swallowed hard and seemed to regain some of his composure.
What I mean is that what he's telling is a true story, and true stories have unpleasant parts. His more than most, I expect. They're messy and tangled, and...
I know you can't get him to leave them out, Bast said, but you can hurry him along. You can help him dwell on the good things. His adventures, the women, the fighting, his travels, his music...
Bast stopped abruptly.
Well, not the music. Don't ask about that, or why he doesn't do magic anymore.
Chronicler frowned.
Why not? His music seems...
Bast's expression was grim.
Just don't, he said firmly. They're not productive subjects.
I stopped you earlier, he tapped Chronicler's shoulder meaningfully, because you were going to ask him what went wrong with his sympathy.
You didn't know any better. Now you do. Focus on the heroics, his cleverness.
He waved his hands.
That sort of thing.
It's really not my place to be steering him one way or another, Chronicler said stiffly. I'm a recorder. I'm just here for the story. The story's the important thing, after all.
Piss on your story, Bast said sharply. You'll do what I say, or I'll break you like a kindling stick.
Chronicler froze. So you're saying I work for you?
I'm saying you belong to me.
Bast's face was deadly serious. Down to the marrow of your bones. I drew you here to serve my purpose. You have eaten at my table, and I have saved your life.
He pointed at Chronicler's naked chest.
3 ways I own you. That makes you wholly mine, an instrument of my desire. You will do as I say.
Chronicler's chin lifted a bit, his expression hardening.
I will do as I see fit, he said, slowly raising a hand to the piece of metal that lay against his naked chest.
Bast's eyes flickered down, then up again.
You think I'm playing at some game? His expression was incredulous. You think iron will keep you safe?
Bast leaned forward, slapped Chronicler's hand away, and grabbed the circle of dark metal before the scribe could move. Immediately, Bast's arms stiffened, and his eyes clenched shut in a grimace of pain. When he reopened them, they were solid blue, the color of deep water or the darkening sky. Bast leaned forward, bringing his face close to Chronicler's. The scribe panicked and tried to scrabble sideways out of the bed, but Bast took hold of his shoulder and held him fast.
Hear my words, manling, he hissed. Do not mistake me for my mask.
You see light dappling on the water and forget the deep, cold dark beneath. The tendons in Bast's hand creaked as he tightened his grip on the circle of iron. Listen. You cannot hurt me. You cannot run or hide. In this, I will not be defied. As he spoke, Bast's eyes grew paler until they were the pure blue of a clear noontime sky. I swear by all the salt in me, if you run counter to my desire, the remainder of your brief mortal span will be an orchestra of misery. I swear by stone and oak and elm, I'll make a game of you. I'll follow you unseen and smother any spark of joy you find. You'll never know a woman's touch, a breath of rest, a moment's peace of mind. Bast's eyes were now the pale blue-white of lightning, his voice tight and fierce. And I swear by the night sky and the ever-moving moon, if you lead my master to despair, I will slit you open and splash around like a child in a muddy puddle. I'll string a fiddle with your guts and make you play it while I dance. Bast leaned closer until their faces were mere inches apart, his eyes gone white as opal, white as a full-bellied moon. You are an educated man. You know there are no such things as demons. Bast smiled a terrible smile. There is only my kind. Bast leaned closer still. Chronicler smelled flowers on his breath. You are not wise enough to fear me as I should be feared. You do not know the first note of the music that moves me. Bast pushed himself away from Chronicler and took several steps back from the bed. Standing at the edge of the candle's flickering light, he opened his hand and the circle of iron fell to the wooden floor, ringing dully. After a moment, Bast drew a slow, deep breath. He ran his hands through his hair. Chronicler remained where he was, pale and sweating. Bast bent to pick up the iron ring by its broken cord, knotting it together again with quick fingers. "Listen, there's no reason we can't be friends," he said matter-of-factly as he turned and held the necklace out to Chronicler. His eyes were a human blue again, his smile warm and charming. "There's no reason we can't all get what we want. You get your story. He gets to tell it. You get to know the truth. He gets to remember who he really is. Everyone wins, and we'll all go our separate ways, pleased as peaches." Chronicler reached out to take hold of the cord, his hand trembling slightly. "What do you get?" he asked, his voice a dry whisper. "What do you want out of this?" The question seemed to catch Bast unprepared. He stood still and awkward for a moment, all his fluid grace gone. For a moment, it looked as if he might burst into tears. "What do I want? I just want my Reshi back." His voice was quiet and lost. "I want him back the way he was." There was a moment of awkward silence. Bast scrubbed at his face with both hands and swallowed hard. "I've been gone too long," he said abruptly, walking to the window and opening it. He paused with one leg over the sill and looked back at Chronicler. "Can I bring you anything before you go to sleep? A nightcap? More blankets?" Chronicler shook his head numbly, and Bast waved as he stepped the rest of the way out the window, closing it gently behind him. Epilogue. A silence of three parts. It was night again. The Waystone Inn lay in silence, and it was a silence of three parts. The first part was a hollow, echoing quiet, made by things that were lacking. If there had been horses stabled in the barn, they would have stamped and champed and broken it to pieces. If there had been a crowd of guests, even a handful of guests bedded down for the night, their restless breathing and mingled snores would have gently thawed the silence like a warm spring wind. If there had been music, but no, of course there was no music. In fact, there were none of these things, and so the silence remained. Inside the Waystone, a man huddled in his deep, sweet-smelling bed, motionless, waiting for sleep, he lay wide-eyed in the dark. In doing this, he added a small, frightened silence to the larger, hollow one. They made an alloy of sorts, a harmony. The third silence was not an easy thing to notice. If you listened for an hour, you might begin to feel it in the thick stone walls of the empty taproom and in the flat, gray metal of the sword that hung behind the bar. It was in the dim candlelight that filled an upstairs room with dancing shadows. It was in the mad pattern of a crumpled memoir that lay fallen and unforgotten atop the desk. And it was in the hands of the man who sat there, pointedly ignoring the pages he had written and discarded long ago. The man had true red hair, red as flame. His eyes were dark and distant, and he moved with the weary calm that comes from knowing many things. The waystone was his, just as the third silence was his. This was appropriate, as it was the greatest silence of the three, wrapping the others inside itself. It was deep and wide as autumn's ending. It was heavy as a great river-smooth stone. It was the patient, cut-flower sound of a man who was waiting to die. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of The Name of the Wind by Patrick Rothfuss. Copyright 2007 by Patrick Rothfuss. Read by Nick Podell. Directed by Colleen Willits. Engineered by Corey Young. Performance copyright 2009 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.